Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Mohamed Mirandi. Mohamed has been on before. We're trying to reach him now, sometimes going long distances to get a guest. We might have a problem or two occasionally. Even the big boys have problems like this. We'll keep trying to get Mohamed during the hour, and as soon as we do, I'll get him onto the program. In the meantime, he just gives me a chance to discuss some of the things that I've been writing about. But just briefly, let me just explain so I don't have to do it again if we connect with Mohamed. He's an associate professor at the University of Tehran. He chairs its North American Studies Department. He does wonderful writing and analysis on Middle East issues, and with everything going on in the region, that's exactly what we need to talk about. I had an early morning interview on Press TV about it. Most of their interviews are a little bit short. I got about 7 or 8 minutes discussing what's going on in Kobani and the situation with the Kurds and so on. I'll get into a little of that during the hour. And on Friday, I'll have another interview on what's going on in the region. The first time ever for me on a London-based independent media operation. And it's the same topic, and they'll have me on discussing it briefly with other guests. And they explained to me that the way they like to run their program. I think I'll go on separately. They said they like to get different views, and they read some of my writing, and they wanted to get me on for the views that I express all the time, countering some of the other views that will be expressed by other guests. I don't know who they are, and I would just as soon have my say without somebody interrupting me, which is what usually happens when you get the kind of people that show up on what I call the scoundrel media. They don't want to let you get a word in edgewise, so they interrupt and drown you out and not giving you a chance to tell people the truth. So hopefully I'll get a segment all to myself, and then the other people will get their segments. And I think that really is a fair way to do it. But there's so much to talk about. Let me jump into one topic first. I want to go to the Middle East because, of course, it's such a major issue going on with the wars, Obama's wars on Iraq and Syria, what really is going on, and the fact that that the Islamic State is really a U.S. proxy force has nothing to do with so-called terrorists America wants to degrade and destroy, one of Obama's many big lies. But this morning I wrote an article about this several years ago, about China emerging to become the world's largest economy. It was several years ago that the IMF projected on what's called a purchasing power basis. In other words, what a basket of a country's currency can buy in terms of goods and services. It doesn't matter how much money you have, it matters what it can buy. So they call it PPP, purchasing power parity. On that basis, the IMF projected that China will overtake America this year by a modest amount, but it's a major achievement. Major achievement. You can imagine the apoplexy going on in Washington, just realizing that America no longer is the world's largest economy. On an absolute GDP basis, it is, but that will pass as well. And the IMF also projected that by 2019, on a PPP basis, China's economy will be 20% greater than America's. Astonishing. In another 5 years, so by the 2020s, on an absolute GDP basis, China will absolutely be the world's largest economy by any basis of standard you want to use. They're basically unstoppable. I titled my article, Crowning the Dragon, America's Top Economy. And it really is quite a story. Began with Deng Xiaoping in 1979 when he decided that he wanted to open China's economy. He wanted to grow it. And China has a problem. even then, my goodness, 35 years ago, it had a huge population. It's much bigger today. You've got to find jobs for these people. You can't have millions and millions and millions of people unemployed. They'll get very angry. They might do something. They might revolt. They might oust the government and put another one in. So it's critical for China, on that basis alone, to be able to have a job creation machine, to be able to get people employed. I just got a message I'm trying to read. You got to get them employed, or maybe they'll rumble enough to want something much better than what they have at the moment. So China is very mindful about this. Policy in terms of economic growth, indeed, has been very, very remarkable for the last 35 years. And Deng Xiaoping coined the phrase. It's been said different ways. I quoted him saying, black cat, white cat, it doesn't matter as long as it catches mice. Got to be a very famous statement. And other things he said, same thing. But he really, in many respects, he went in the right direction. In other respects, you know, this writer does not have very much good to say about predatory capitalism. And it certainly is true in China the way it is in the West. And people are exploited. They're taken advantage of. Big companies get all the advantages. Ordinary people are used like production inputs. You know, you use them, you pay the minimal amounts, no more than you have to, and it's the big boys who make all the money, and that's the way the system works. Not the way it worked in the small family business I was involved in. We knew nothing about predatory capitalism. I had to learn it on myself to really understand what it was all about. But small business, the opposite of the Walmarts of the world and the Monsantos and the IBMs and so on, entirely different, more like a family than a major corporation. And we were a corporation, but we were a private one. And I'm proud to say that we ran the business responsibly, caring about our customers, caring about our people, and doing okay, and doing it without stealing it, without taking advantage of people, without preying on them for profit. And it certainly was not the way I was brought up to operate that way. In any event, a major milestone is being reached this year, and China is indeed number one. It's also a very powerful military country. It doesn't want to use that military might, but it wants it to be able to protect itself against predatory America. And I think listeners are well aware of Obama's Asia pivot, the idea of America going into China's backyard, setting up bases, doing what it's doing to Russia, surrounding both countries with U.S. bases, NATO bases, or maybe standalone U.S. bases. This can only lead to trouble. I use the phrase all the time, heading toward East-West confrontation. I mean, we're talking about something that can approach global war or can actually be global war. And in this program, I've talked about the former head of America's nuclear navy, Hyman Rickover, saying, telling Congress in very unequivocal terms that when nations go to war, to win it, they will use every weapon in their arsenal. So if there ever is a war, heaven forbid, between China and America, or Russia and America, all three countries nuclear powers. Just imagine what that could turn out to be. A nuclear war? We never had it during the Cold War. So-called mutual assured destruction kept the world from nuclear Armageddon. And I never was really worried about nuclear war, except when I was a very young kid in grammar school. And back in those days, they used to hold drills. No television in those days, thank heavens, but they used to have drills, and my grammar school had a fire escape. They used to take us, I can't remember if they had us duck under desks, but I do remember they took us down the fire escape. They had us assemble in the schoolyard in the back with wonderful memories of the games I used to play with friends way, way back in the 1940s, into the 1930s, early 1940s, all through the Second World War. Now, can you imagine if there was a nuclear war, what good it would do to go down the fire escape and assemble in the schoolyard? Well, anyway, that was the drill they put us through. So when I was 6 or 7 years old, what did I know? I was a little scared about what could happen. When I got a little older and began to get a little savvy about some of the things going on, I realized the chances for nuclear war really were pretty slim. And when I began writing, I discovered Russia, well, the Soviet Union until 1991, was so battered by World War II that it didn't again become a normal country until around 1960. You know, NATO supposedly was established as a defense against supposed Russian aggression. What Russian aggression? Russia lost, nobody knows how many people Russia lost, 20 million, 30 million, 40 million, and their economy and their infrastructure was absolutely decimated, even under Stalin until 1953, and then Khrushchev and the other leaders. They were in no position to threaten anybody to wage war, and America knew it, and European countries knew it, and the idea of establishing NATO as the defense against a virtually defenseless country, this is the way Western policy is run. Well, I caught on a little bit enough to know that I really wasn't all that scared back then, but I sure am scared now. I think it's very possible we could have a global war, an East-West confrontation that could lead to a global war, and if it happens, there's a very strong possibility it could be a nuclear war. I believe Hyman Rickover was right. To win the war, when countries go to war, they want to win it. And if there's a war between America and Russia or China, America will go all out to win it, including using nuclear weapons. And there were U.S. generals way back and today, I do believe, who absolutely believe that America should use nuclear weapons. Back in Jack Kennedy's days, people like Curtis LeMay, a World War II hero, tried to convince Kennedy to use nuclear weapons against Russia, to nuke them while we had an advantage. Well, thankfully, we had Kennedy back in those days. And I wrote about once during a national security meeting, I think a different general got up and really espoused the same lunatic notion. And Kennedy was so furious, he did what no U.S. president would do today. He got up in the middle of the meeting and stormed out. And later he said, I believe to his Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, what kind of lunatics are these people? He wanted nothing to do with them. He wanted nothing to do with extending war. He wanted the current wars ended. He wanted all troops out of Vietnam by the end of 1964. He wanted all kinds of responsible policies. But of all the ones he was in favor of, I think the one that got himself killed was wanting to end imperial wars. That is the biggest no-no. So he was replaced. Lyndon Johnson took his place. I think he was involved in killing him. Senior Bush, I think, was involved in killing him. And, of course, Lyndon Johnson revved up the war in Southeast Asia. And instead of ending it in 1964, it didn't end until 11 years later. Just imagine if we had Kennedy until the end of 1968. What a different world it would have been. Would it have made a difference? Somebody else would have come in. We probably would have gotten the same stuff we're getting now. But we could have had another 5-plus years of peace. We didn't get them. And I mentioned on this program that he was my commencement speaker as a junior Massachusetts senator in 1956. I didn't remember what he said, but I looked it up and I read it. And it was so wonderful I had to write about it, which I did. And in the article I made comments like, politicians don't speak the way he did then. And indeed they don't. We sure could use a Jack Kennedy today, but there aren't any. And the fact that he was murdered by the CIA, of course, not by Lee Harvey Oswald, who was a convenient dupe. And, of course, he was murdered, so dead men tell no tales. That's the way policy is run. But absolutely, the regime got rid of him so the wars could continue, and they've gone on every year without end from then to now, revved up to do more. And we see what's going on in the Middle East. Obama's third war, well, his first war against Iraq, the third war against Iraq, first one, of course, January 1991. For some reason, I remember where I was and what I was doing when war broke out. I was in a hotel involved in a program that my company was running in Chicago, and somebody broke, I didn't have the television set on, but somebody broke the news. It was, I believe, an early afternoon, Chicago time. Somebody broke the news that we're bombing Baghdad. Well, that kind of brought the house to a standstill, which is not what I wanted. I wanted to get on with business and run what I came to the hotel to do. But we got back to business in short order. But it was kind of shocking to learn that America was at war against a defenseless country that certainly did not threaten America, based, of course, on big lies, all wars are based on big lies, and that was only one of many. And then, of course, Bush's war in 2003, the lawless sanctions in between that observers who knew what was going on said it killed about 1.5 million Iraqis. 1.5 million Iraqis, starving them to death, depriving them of the necessary medicines they needed. This was U.S. policy. Bill Clinton. We know what Senior Bush did. Too few people know what Bill Clinton did. He was responsible for maybe 1.5 million Iraqi lives. And then, of course, Bush, too, came in, and we all know that story very well. Did Obama miss a beat? Not at all. He continued where Bush left off. Crimes of war and against humanity, what I like to call high crimes against peace. And they certainly proliferated, and Obama didn't miss a beat, and that's exactly what's going on. The Islamic State, or ISIL, or ISIS, give them any name you want. These people, they're bad guys, for sure. They're not Syrians, for the most part. Some of them are expats, but basically they're imported from other countries, from all over the world, mostly in the region, but also from America, from Europe, possibly from anywhere. They're trained by U.S. Special Forces and CIA operatives in Jordan, in Turkey, some of them in Georgia, not the state of Georgia, Georgia, the former Soviet Republic. This is what's going on. They're taught the fine art of killing, committing atrocities, terrible atrocities, including beheadings. The worse, the better. This is what's going on. And then they're deployed cross-border into Syria for the purpose of being America's foot soldiers, a proxy military, to wage war against Bashar al-Assad, to oust him and replace him with a stooge pro-Western government. That's the dirty plan. That's what's been going on since March 1911. And a phrase I use over and over again is, Syria is Obama's war. And indeed it is. And Bashar al-Assad is doing what any responsible leader should do. His country was invaded. His people depend on him. He's protecting them by attacking these people. And when he gets accused of committing high crimes, these are big lies. He's doing, again, what any responsible leader should do. He's waging war against foreign invaders. To do anything less would be irresponsible. So I support him fully. Syrians support him fully. In June, in early June, on the 3rd of June, he was reelected by nearly 89% in a presidential election. Independent monitors judged open, free, and fair. I wrote about it, but it was the day that I had to go into Northwestern Memorial Hospital for what I thought was a very minor problem. They kept me there and in rehab for 2 months. So I never did, and I was offline. I didn't know what the heck was going on. I didn't know what the final margin of victory was. When I got home and got back, I wrote a follow-up article. Even though it was 2 months late, I combined it in another article. I felt I had to say something about it, and it just appalled me that I couldn't. My article was really a two-part article. I wrote part one on the day I went into the hospital. I first wrote the article, and then I went down and was admitted. But I felt I had to write part two, which is what I did. And I saw that 88 point something like 7-8% majority, an incredible majority. It showed that the Syrian people really do want Assad to leave them, and they absolutely do not want anybody else. But will you ever get that in the scoundrel media? Of course, you'll never get it. You'll never be told that the Syrians support Assad overwhelmingly. And they do for good reason, because without him, Syria would be in much, much worse shape than it is now. It would be a caliphate. It would be a cauldron of violence, the same way that Libya is, Iraq is, Afghanistan is, and the Syrian people deserve better. Of course, they're not getting it because Obama's war is raging without end. But the Islamic State and the Nusra Front and Al-Qaeda and other groups by various names, some of them, I guess, act independently, but a lot of them are basically American foot soldiers. They're fighting America's wars for regime change to get the puppets in that America wants and the sovereign independent leaders out that America does not want. And this is the dirty game of imperialism that goes on all the time. It certainly keeps me busy writing about it, so I did. And, of course, this is what's happening right now in Syria. There's a siege going on in Kobani. Kobani is a Syrian town. It's on the border with Turkey. I wrote about it yesterday. Turkey is playing a dirty game. It's a NATO member, so it basically is part of the Atlantic Alliance, doing America's bidding. You know, NATO, a kind of all-for-one, one-for-all alliance. When America wants to go to war, the other countries dare not say no. If America calls on them, they have to go. Where supposedly the purpose of NATO is, under its so-called Article 5, if one nation is attacked, it's the obligation of the other 28 nations to come to its defense. Well, who threatens NATO? Who threatens America? Who threatens Western European countries? The way I like to put it, their only enemies are the ones they invent. They certainly have none. They haven't had any for a very, very long time. So they invent them. They have to invent them because none exist. They need to invent them to wage wars, permanent wars, without end. And that's exactly what goes on. So millions of people have died just post 9/11 alone. I don't exaggerate saying it. I'll say it again. Millions of people have died, not just from violence, but from deprivation, from hunger, from disease, from all of the fallout of imperial wars. Horrific. Afghanistan alone. Conceivably, a few million people died. Afghanistan is a decimated country. Of course, Iraq is the same thing, the cradle of civilization. Senior Bush and Junior Bush destroyed it, and Obama is destroying it again. And, of course, Afghanistan, America's longest war. Syria, been ongoing since March 2011. Where is the anti-war movement? Some responsible people ask that. I ask it. If you look at polls, you see the majority of Americans want America's wars ended, especially Afghanistan, because it's the longest war ongoing since October 2001, about 5 weeks after 9/11. You don't wage wars that quickly. The war was planned many months before 9/11. At least, minimally, 6 months on the shelf, ready to go. 9/11 happened. State-sponsored terrorism had nothing to do with bin Laden, had nothing to do with crazed Arabs. There it went, the big day. Who could ever forget it who was alive and old enough to remember it then? I certainly can never forget it, and I've written about it a number of times. The war was launched about 5 weeks later. Bombing, invasion, destroying a country that's been battered by war for decades. Probably, John Pilger said it, I don't have his direct quote in front of me, but probably no country in modern history has suffered more than Afghanistan. Pilger's words, not mine. And it's true, you could go back generations and see how the people of Afghanistan have been so abused for so many generations, but you could take it back to the great games of the 19th century. And it went on then, and it's going on now, and there's no end in sight. How the Afghan people put up with it, I don't know. And America isn't leaving Afghanistan. It'll pull a bunch of forces out, but it'll leave 10 or 20,000 in. It's got a pro-Western stooge government running things. Well, the guy who's going out, Hamid Karzai, a former Union Oil executive, a former CIA asset, a president of Afghanistan, I forget his election day, but for about a dozen years, illegitimate all the way, and there'll be something like a coalition government replacing him, another illegitimate government. So these are the kind of people that will run the country, cheating the people, running the country for their own self-interest, stealing all they can. Afghanistan is one of the world's most corrupt countries. It's also very important for America to keep the country flourishing because it's the largest producer of opium in the world. And opium is the root substance for heroin. And Afghanistan produces more of it than the entire world demand. The amount goes up and down over the years. But the Taliban got rid of opium, and that was one of the reasons they had to go. So they're back. So the stooge government is in. Opium is flourishing. Farmers can't make any money growing broccoli, so they grow opium, and at least they can make something. to get enough food in their bodies for themselves and their children to survive as best they can. And the CIA gets billions and billions of dollars from the opium trade, and so don't the major banks. It works like this. Weekly, maybe once a week, maybe more than once a week, limousines drive up to the major banks, J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Wells Fargo, and the others, with suitcases full of hard cash. They bring them into the bank. They're deposited in appropriate accounts for the people, for the drug barons. They make loads of money, and so don't the big banks. So illicit drug money is a major Wall Street profit center. It also gives the CIA enormous amounts of money so they can run their illicit operations, part of the dirty business that never gets reported in the scoundrel media. So the opium trade is extremely important, and waging wars extremely important. There was a blurb, I forget which one of the media put it out, that the stocks of the major defense contractors are just going crazy. All-time highs, you know, Lockheed and Boeing and the others, some of the smaller ones that people are less familiar with, but they're going crazy. They're making all kinds of money. The more wars America wages, the more missiles and bombs and so on are used, the more that has to be produced, and the defense contractors make tons and tons of money. So everybody gets into the act, everybody profits, and the only people who don't are the ones who get mass slaughtered and the incredible destruction that takes place. And then the reconstruction, so I guess the people involved in that make loads and loads of money. But that's the dirty game that goes on. It's a pretty awful game. The worst of it is the people that are being killed. So we have what's going on in Kobani. I think what's happening there, I think listeners have probably read about it. The city is under siege. I'll check later to see if there are any new developments. But the city is under siege. There are Kurdish fighters who want to come in to help their brethren in the city. And Turkey has their tanks and military marshaled on the border, and they won't let the Turkish fighters in. And I think the dirty game goes something like this. Turkey, of course, is doing America's bidding. I think the idea is to create a massacre, make it a bad one, to get people in Western countries and elsewhere to be furious about what's happened, for the purpose of enlisting more U.S. coalition partners to wage war on Syria on the pretext of going after Islamic State fighters. But the real target is Syria and Bashar al-Assad, and the purpose is regime change. That's what the dirty game is. But to get people involved, you have to energize them. You have to convince them that something is really the right thing to do. Americans don't want to go to war. A slight diversion. During the Nuremberg trials, a trial psychologist asked Hermann Göring before he committed suicide, "How did you guys get the German people to go along with what you wanted to do?" And his answer was very simple. Nobody wants to go to war. Farmers don't want to leave their fields and go to war. You got to scare the hell out of them. You got to convince them their families are in danger. This is what you have to do. And if they think that they need to do something to protect their families, they'll do whatever they have to do. And that's exactly the dirty game going on. You scare the bejesus out of the public, the Western public, the U.S. public. You show them that Islamic fighters are bad guys. They behead people. They murder people en masse. They use chemical weapons, but you don't tell them that. All the chemical weapons attacks have been used by these fighters, not the Syrian government. But you enrage people by telling them big lies about what they supposedly do, which they do not, and you enlist public support that way. And that's the way the dirty game is played. So I think what's happening is the game is to commit atrocities, let these people in, let them commit atrocities, more beheadings, mass slaughter, daily headlines in the major media, the scoundrel media, to get America as angry about what's going on as they have been about the beheadings of four people. You know, the two U.S. journalists, the British guy, I think an Australian guy, was beheaded. It showed that even though the vast majority of Americans want America's wars ended, the vast majority also think America should go to war against Islamic State fighters. Does it make sense? It makes no sense at all. It shows what I've quoted in a few articles from time to time. The way back in 1950, when television was pretty new, and my family didn't have a television set. We didn't have one until I was a junior in high school. But the president of Boston University then, I grew up in Boston, said, I can just about quote him verbatim, if this thing catches on, we'll end up with a nation of morons. We have a nation of morons. Not entirely, and there are lots of people who do catch on. And I'm very encouraged by the fact that more and more people, increasing numbers of people, are turning out scoundrel media. It's wonderful. They're watching less and less cable news. The broadcast news people, the CBS, ABC, NBC, they don't have the viewership that they used to have. I suspect that they'll go out of business entirely. But the cable news channels, their ratings are abysmal. People, increasing number of people, simply don't trust what they have to say, so they're turning out. They still watch garbage, the other garbage that they run, whether it's movies or sitcoms or whatever it is, but increasing numbers are turning away from managed news misinformation, as I like to call it. It's wonderful. And just imagine if they all opted out. It's the best way, it's the only corporate operation I know that ordinary people can put out of business by simply not buying their services, watching their big lies, following what they have to say, whether it's on television, whether it's in print. If you stop doing it, they'll lose their advertisers. If they lose their advertisers, they go out of business. What a wonderful world it would be if we didn't have corporate media big lies. It would be marvelous if ordinary people turn in greater numbers to independent media all the time for real news, PRN, and other independent media to get what people really need to know. And it's right there, and it's either cheap or free. Imagine that. And in most cases, commercial free, so you don't have to put up with the garbage people are selling. Everything to sell, as a media critic once said, and nothing to tell. And that's exactly what they are. Garbage, round the clock, rubbish, certainly not anything people want to know. Big lies, proliferating, cable channels, round the clock. So anytime you tune in to the cable channels, Fox, MSNBC, CNN, you're going to get round-the-clock big lies. I check once in a while to see where they're going, but when I have it on, I want to see the stories they're covering, and I usually have it on mute. When I was out of commission for a couple of months and wasn't able to go online, the only thing I had was were these operations or looking at the walls and ceiling. I turned it on a good bit, but I kept it on mute just to see where they were going. Pretty awful stuff, painful listening. Now I just check it very briefly to see what direction they're taking, knowing full well that they're proliferating lies and they're not telling people what they need to know. And this is the dirty game they play. It's the only game they play. Well, this is what keeps me busy writing. I'm doing another media critique today. I do lots of them. I've done many, many media critiques. I'll have another one. I wrote about the China situation becoming the world's largest economy. I have another one I think I'll try to get done in Israel, and I'm writing an article, another media critique. I've done a number of them lately, and this will be another one. And again, exposing their big lies, not telling people what they most need to know. Pretty outrageous, but again, it's encouraging the increasing numbers that people are catching on, and it's so simple to opt out and go another way and find out what you need to know, and so important because the crimes that are being committed against us, that they're doing so much harm. They're harming us, they're harming our families, they're harming our children. It's far worse. It never was good, but it's far worse than it ever was when I was a kid growing up. It was awful then, but it's pretty terrible today, pathetic. And the lies that are proliferated literally cause so much harm to so many people. And if most people realized it and turned out, think how much better things could be. So we have that situation raging. We have, of course, the war going on in Iraq at the same time. the situation in Palestine. It bothered me so much that I couldn't write about Israel's war on Palestine, so-called Operation Protective Edge. It was genocide by any other standard, literally genocide. And the people of Gaza were decimated. Forget the exact numbers that were killed, over 2,000, maybe 2,300, maybe 11,000 wounded. Large parts of Gaza just turned into rubble, and virtually nothing has been done so far to get life back in order. So Gazans have lost their homes, they've lost their futures, they've lost their loved ones. There's no accountability whatsoever. It bothered me so much that I was completely unable to write about it. The first article I wrote when I got home, the next day, I got home on August 6th, and the next day I wrote an article. I knew what the title would be. I called it Back from the Abyss, and I explained to my readers what happened to me and why I wasn't around. I felt I owed them that explanation, but I combined it with an article writing about some of the things I would have done had I been able to do it. I wrote about Israel's war. I wrote about the war on Syria, and I put it all into one article, and then I continued in the following days. But again, from Israel has waged three major wars against Gaza since December 2008. Call it two major ones and one minor one. Castellet in December 2008, in January 2009 for 22 days, as I recall. Operation Pillar of Cloud, November 2012, for about 8 or 9 days, as I recall, and then Operation Protective Edge for 51 days, worse than the other two combined, and then some. And again, the decimation that was done to ordinary people with no accountability, and all the big lies that proliferated on why the war was waged. It had nothing to do with Hamas rockets. It had nothing to do with Israel's security. It had everything to do with preventing Palestinian self-determination, with preventing real Fatah and Hamas unity, with preventing preventing Palestine from having control over its own resources, its own borders and airspace and waters, for having Jerusalem as its legitimate capital. These were the big issues. They still are the big issues why Israel wages wars, to prevent these things from happening. Back in 1993, the so-called Oslo Accords, I remember where I was then, by golly, in another hotel at another one of the events my company was involved in. And I remember it like it was yesterday. And I did turn the television set on because I knew what was going on. It was a famous handshake in the I forget which of the gardens at the White House it took place, the Rose Garden or one of them. But the famous handshake, Bill Clinton and Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin, the Prime Minister of Israel at the time, the famous handshake, the Oslo Accords, peace, some peace. And there were so-called final status issues, the major ones, like Jerusalem East Jerusalem as Palestine's legitimate capital, and the borders and self-determination and so on. And the final status issues were put off for a later date. And there were other agreements that followed Oslo. Oslo II, White River, Bush's agreements, or various names that were given to them. And the final status issues that were put off from 1993 never happened. Palestinians are still waiting for them, still waiting for what never happened. So the same dirty game is going on now. Put the tough things off for the future. They'll never get resolved. Palestinians will never get liberation. And again, the same dirty game repeats. We had one intifada in the late 1980s. We had another one in 2000. There's another one. It really is kind of going slow motion. And it'll perk up a little bit when Palestinians, again, get even angrier than they are now. They've been cheated since, dare I say, 1948, May 1948. And Harry Truman was the first world leader on his own to recognize the new state of Palestine at around midnight Eastern Time, America, and he sent a letter that he hand wrote, and he crossed out something in it. I wrote about it years ago. He crossed out something in it, one line, and replaced it with another line. But basically, he wanted America to be the first nation anywhere to recognize the new state of Israel. And how did it come into being? By mass slaughtering and displacing hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who thought one day they would be able to go home and regain what they lost, but they never were able to come home, and they lost everything, including loved ones. Maybe several hundred thousand were murdered in cold blood. Maybe 800,000 were forcibly displaced. Many of them live in other countries, in Jordan, in Syria, in other regional countries, in the West Bank, in refugee camps, in Gaza, in refugee camps. They experience extreme deprivation, not the ones who were living then, but their children and their grandchildren, and it never ends. And here we just had another Israeli war. I wrote about an Israeli general who waged the war, General Gantz, IDF chief of staff. He's retiring in about 4 months, in January, I believe. And Haaretz, a leading Israeli newspaper, interviewed him. And one of the headlines of the article was, I nearly gagged when I read it, after mass slaughtering Palestinians, leaving large parts of Gaza in rubble, committing horrendous war crimes and crimes against humanity. He said he wanted to give Gazans hope, quote-unquote, hope. Hope? What kind of hope do they have? They can only look forward to more war, more decimation, more mass destruction, more mass slaughter, and another general will take his place and will deliver the same thing in another year or 2 years or 3 years. The pattern just repeats. And he made a comment in his interview that we'll probably have a few quiet years from now on. Well, there should have been quiet years all along because Hamas didn't begin the war that Israel waged. Israel began the war. Israel began it on false pretexts. Again, it had nothing to do with Hamas or Hamas rockets. It had everything to do with the things I listed. That's exactly what Israel's wars are based on. They initiate them. They launched them preemptively. Hamas never does. Usually, it takes multiple provocations before Hamas and other liberation groups respond. They respond to Israeli aggression. They have every right to do it. It's written into international law. It is not Hamas aggression. It's Israeli aggression. And again, it repeats endlessly. It's an easy bet to make. It'll happen repeatedly in another year or two or three, but it will happen, and there'll be many more Palestinian deaths. Shocking, but it simply continues, going back to the roots of when this happened. Before 1948, it began with the Balfour Declaration in 1917 when Britain, that had controlled a large part of the region, wanted a Western influence in the region. So it decided to establish a Jewish state. And then the war really began. It began in 1947 and wrapped up in 1948. And the people of Palestinians have suffered horrendously through it all and ever since. With no justice for them all, no liberation. But one day I hope it really will come. There are a few people anyway who deserve it more, and certainly I'm on their side. So it's a major topic for me to write about all the time, and I'll continue writing about it. Very likely another article on it going out today. But I want to get out the one. I got out the one on China earlier this morning, and I'm doing another media critique. I'll get that out. That needs to get out, to do some bashing on that. And usually the way I begin my day is to do my standard due diligence, to see what's making headlines, decide what I think really needs prominence in the day. And usually it's in one of the war theaters, but it can be on anything. I'll tell you what I've been writing about. If listeners haven't been taking a look, anybody can check it out on my blog site, Steve Lenman blog. I wrote an article a couple of days ago on Obama's economy, and I trashed the economy. The idea that the economy is good is another one of the big lies. The economy is abysmal. It's terrific for the 1%. It's okay for the top, for the other 9 of the top 10%. It's rotten for most of the others. Rotten. Ordinary people have rotten jobs. When you see a jobs report come out, the latest one was, with government and private sector jobs. I believe the number was 248,000 new jobs created. What kind of jobs? Low pay, poor and no benefit, part-time or temp jobs. The kind people wouldn't touch a few decades ago. Manufacturing jobs, the good ones, and good service jobs have been offshored to China, to Bangladesh, to Guatemala, to places like this. And the rotten ones are left. Oh, it's wonderful if you want to be a bartender or a cook or a maid, maybe an ambulance driver. You can probably get a job. Part-time, not full-time, part-time, and you get rotten pay, or if you want to go to work for Walmart's or McDonald's, rotten pay, poor and no benefits, you need at least two of these to survive, and if you're married, your spouse needs at least one. Again, Obama's economy, so when he tells you things are great, and he featured it in his weekly radio address, and I quoted from him, and I love to quote what somebody like Obama has to say, or John Kerry, and then have a section I call Fact Check, and tell the truth, and explain what's really going on. And when he tells you the economy is great, read my fact checks and find out the economy is rotten. And it's not getting better, it's getting worse. What else did I write about? I wrote about strengthening Sino-Russia ties. I wrote about this before. When Russia and China consummated a major energy deal, one that will extend for 30 years, $30 billion. Before it's over, it could be double, maybe triple that amount. An enormous deal involving a lot more than energy, mainly gas and oil, but also other products and services, weapons. Russia is turning increasingly east. The sanctions are doing nothing, basically nothing, to hurt China's economy. Just kind of nicking it a little bit. Completely counterproductive, accomplishing nothing. Russia is turning increasingly east, doing more business with China, and China, of course, is relying more and more on Russia. But at the same time, Russia prefers doing business with everybody. It prefers partners in all areas. So it seeks Western partners, and certainly Western European ones do not want to shut out Russia. It's very important to their own welfare. But there was a blurb this morning I haven't read yet that Russia and China have now signed 50 new agreements, 5-0, 50 new agreements. You can just imagine how many billions of dollars are involved in them. I'll take a look at it and see what it has to say. I don't want to write about it again because I just put out an article. And if I do, I need to repeat some of what I said before to explain exactly what's going on because it's important to tell people. But anyway, 50 new agreements between these countries. What else did I talk about? An awful lot on Syria, an awful lot on Israel, media critiques, of course, and a good deal explaining exactly what these so-called terrorist groups are all about. The Islamic State and Nusra Front and so on, explaining what they're about because it's very important to let people go. These are not bad guys that America is going all out to get rid of. Exactly the opposite. They're bad guys America is using to get rid of the good guys they want to eliminate. I had a small health problem. I had to go back for treatment as an inpatient for a few days. I did it while the UN addresses were taking place in New York, the General Assembly addresses. The day I got back, I used it as my General Assembly address catch-up day. I wrote about Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister. I wrote about Obama. I wrote Obama, before I went in for treatment. I wrote about Netanyahu. Netanyahu showed up after most of the others, and I wrote a wonderful one about Argentinian President Fernanda. Fernandez de Kirchner, President of Argentina. Let me give you her exact full surname. Cristina, I forgot her first name. Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. She wrote about America's predatory capitalist economy, Western predatory capitalist economies, and she bashed it. She bashed them responsibly. I couldn't get a text of her full address. I got snippets of it, but enough to give me to let me be able to write about what she had to say and to be able to quote her verbatim and be able to fill in explaining exactly what's going on and the harm it does with things like IMF diktats mandating privatizations and mass layoffs and eliminating social benefits, enriching rich people more than they are already. These are the things that go on in an IMF predatory capitalist world. So I wrote about this, and Kirchner bashed them, and one of the three articles I wrote was about what she had to say. Had I had a full text of her comments, I would have written even more. But I wrote an awful lot about it, and it filled out a very, very extensive article. I also wrote about what President Hassan Rouhani had to say in an article, in a separate article I combined with another topic. I wrote about him separately. So it was four articles on UN addresses, but I addressed separate ones to Kirchner, to Netanyahu, and Obama was separate, and who was my other one? Well, any event, four in total, and I got three of them out on the same day. Lavrov, Sergei Lavrov, who I love to quote all the time, a responsible foreign minister who, when he gives a talk, when he has a Q&A, he responsibly says what needs to be said, like promoting peace and ending wars, the exact opposite of U.S. policy, of explaining that Russia... My goodness, I haven't said a word about Ukraine in this program. Very briefly, he's explained unequivocally that Russia has gone all out for peace in Ukraine and certainly has not invaded, has done nothing to wage war in southeastern Ukraine. It's done exactly the opposite. It's acted responsibly. It gets bashed for doing it. Putin gets bashed for doing it. He's geopolitically opposite Obama. Obama can't wait to wage another war. Putin goes all out to stop them, and so does Lavrov. And I've mentioned several times that if anyone deserves a Nobel Peace Prize, these two leaders do. And I believe this Friday will come up to the time when another Nobel Peace Laureate will be named. You can imagine the kind of person who'll get it. It certainly won't be a peace promoter. It'll be a war promoter. We know Obama had his day. The EU was last year. And it'll be another outrageous award this year. It certainly will not be Putin and Lavrov. And for all they've done promoting peace, I honestly can't think of any other two people who deserve a real Nobel Peace Prize more than they do. Of course they won't get it. And of course I'll write about whoever does get it. I feel that's my responsibility to do. And I'll write about what's going on in Ukraine. We're in an interregnum period right now. I just have a few minutes left. We're in an interregnum period right now. Back on September 5th, ceasefire terms were agreed on both sides. The people I call Southeast Ukrainian freedom fighters and the ones who I call fascist putschists waging war at Washington's behest against their own people, murdering them in cold blood, killing them, mass slaughtering them, shelling them, bombing them, and this is what's been going on. This is what Putin, Lavrov, have gone all out to end, to literally turn war around and have peace. Well, war has been going on. Even though we supposedly have a ceasefire in place, war has been continuing on an everyday basis, not as horrendously as it did when it was all out. It's been a little bit sporadic, but there are people living in the region who say the shelling never stopped. It goes on daily, and people are being killed on both sides. Something has to be done to stop it. Certainly, the Ukrainians aren't doing it. And Washington wants the war to continue because it wants total control over Ukraine. It wants Ukraine made part of NATO. Wants part of the U.S., the U.N. The EU. It wants Ukraine made part of the EU. It wants it to be able to exploit it for corporate profits. It wants it made part of NATO so U.S. bases can be strung along Russia's border. A 1,500-kilometer border that runs from the Arctic to the Black Sea, American bases, a hugely provocative act if it happens, and it's coming if NATO incorporates Ukraine. This is the dirty policy that goes on. It's what Russia opposes and absolutely opposes. Russia will go all out short of war to oppose this from happening, but there's a good chance it will happen. And if it does happen, you're going to see U.S. bases on Russia's borders. Can you imagine Russia or Chinese bases on U.S. borders? What would happen if they were in Canada, if they were in Mexico, if Russian ships patrolled America's east or west coasts, if they patrolled the Gulf of Mexico? These would be casus belli for war. But this is America's plan. Dirty, ugly, awful. And that's why the phrase I repeat over and over again is we're heading for a very likely East-West confrontation that simply could erupt into global war. And the lunatics that are making policy in America risk something like this happening. Literally lunatics. And Obama letting this happen, letting people like this make policy, let neocons make policy, risking what I call the unthinkable. The unthinkable. The notion that we should have any war at all is unthinkable. But we're certainly waging wars. They go on without end. And the possibility that East could challenge West and that it could develop into a global war is very, very serious business. And anybody responsible should go all out to prevent it. Well, I don't have the power to prevent it, but I certainly talk about it all the time. I'm just about out of time. I've got about a minute left. I'll reschedule Mohammed Mirandi. I think we probably got messed up on the time. They went back on daylight time, and I told Mohammed of the time difference between us, but I suspect that we got messed up on the time change. Ordinarily, when we're on daylight time in both places, it's a 9.5-hour difference. When it's not, it's an 8.5-hour difference. I think that's what happened, but I'll get him back on again, and we'll have another wonderful program. And what's happening in the Middle East will not go away. The same thing will happen. I've got to sign off. Make this program a regular habit. Indeed, I hope you will. And PRN, and I'll be back with another program. Tune in.